From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, everybody's familiar with antenna tuners. You are, I am. We've used them for many years. All of my tuners, up until relatively recent times that I've used, have been there in the station with me, sitting right next to the radio. However, many people now are using so-called remote antenna tuners that are not at the radio. They could be out at the antenna. And those offer some interesting advantages, don't they?
They do indeed. And that's, by the way, we could spend a lot of time talking about what the two words antenna tuner actually mean. But I don't think we want to do that because everybody really knows what they do.
Yes.
So that's it was a controversial subject for some years.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, we'll call them antenna tuners and we'll all know what we're talking about. And what an antenna tuner does, it's basically a variable impedance transformer. So you put in a load with a particular impedance on, let's call it the antenna side of the antenna tuner. And the antenna tuner, either by itself if it's automatic or by your hand motion if it's not, can transform most impedances to a 50-ohm load that your radio would like to see. So what it does is it transforms from an unmatched condition to a matched condition, typically to 50 ohms that your radio and your transmission line would like to see. Now, the key advantage of the remote antenna tuner is if this happens out at the antenna, that means once it's adjusted, the transmission line between the tuner and the radio will be matched, which will mean it will be operating at the lowest loss that it can operate at.
Yes.
The same tuner, if put at the radio, could make the radio just as happy. The radio will still see 50 ohms, and the antenna tuner will match whatever impedance ends up at the radio end of the transmission line. But that whole length of transmission line will be mismatched, and that will result in additional loss.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that when they have the tuner in their shack tuned to, say, a 1-to-1 SWR, they think that 1-to-1 SWR extends all the way out to the antenna, and it doesn't.
Absolutely not. The antenna system itself, including the transmission line, has a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. But that piece of transmission line between the radio and the, or between the back of the tuner and the antenna, is operating possibly at a high SWR. And in fact, one of the things about the antenna tuner is, in general, unless you've taken some data, you don't know what that SWR is. You can bypass it and measure it, which I recommend everybody do if it's at the station. Then you'll find out what you're really up against. And the numbers can be quite dramatic. I just have a few numbers here. I don't want to go through the whole thing. But if we talk about, let's say we have 100 feet of RG8X, the fairly popular small foam coax that a lot of people use for antennas, 50-ohm coax. And if we're talking about 10 meters, if that transmission line is matched so it has a 50-ohm load, which is what you'd get if you had the tuner out at the antenna, you would still lose 1.9 decibels, which actually is 35% of your power, which is fairly significant.
Yes.
But let's say instead you had a 10-to-1 SWR, which is quite reasonable for some antennas, then that transmission line would have a 5.3 dB loss in 100 feet, which means you'd lose 71% of your power. So your 100-watt transmitter is happily putting out 100 watts into the tuner at your station.
And you think everything is fine.
And you think everything is fine. The radio thinks everything's fine. All the indications are great. You're actually talking to people. But actually only 29 of your watts actually get to the antenna. The rest of it is warming up the transmission line.
Whoa.
So that's the difference. So if that same tuner were out at the antenna, you would get roughly twice as much power to the antenna. You'd have 35% loss. So that's kind of dramatic, and that's what you're up against. And that's why you might want to have a tuner out at the antenna or closer to the antenna. It can be any place in the line. And, of course, if it's not all the way to the antenna, you have a shorter length of transmission line from the output of the tuner to the antenna. Sometimes you don't want to hoist the tuner up in a tree or something. But if you can down to the tuner with a short piece of coax and then have a long run to the station, you will be a lot better off in terms of loss.
Yes. Now, the times that I've played with remote tuners, there are some, and without getting into brand names, that are truly designed for remote operation. They're weather resistant. You can put them right out there in the antenna. It can rain and snow on them, and you know they should be okay. Other tuners are automatic antenna tuners, especially the RF sensing type that just start tuning immediately when you apply a signal. But of course, they're not made for outdoor use. So I've taken some of these and I put them into weather-resistant boxes and have put those out at the antenna with reasonable success.
That's a good point. And you know, I've heard people say that even those that are supposed to be weatherproof don't always stay weatherproof.
No.
And it's not a bad idea to perhaps put an additional layer of something around them. You know, but they are not a panacea. The tuner in the shack has some advantages as well. We should mention those just so people have all the aspects of this at their fingertips. An indoor tuner that's at the station or perhaps built into the radio has the advantage. Typically, they have multiple antenna terminal outputs, so you can use that one tuner to tune as many antennas as there are connectors. In addition to switching, the indoor tuner often provides some metering indication of what's happening, and you can tell whether it's tuning or whether it's not tuning, what's going on, and have a little better feel for what's happening. And that's to the plus. So there are advantages both ways. With the remote tuners, typically, now you could have a remote switch on the output side of a remote tuner, but it adds a little complication. But that, you know, that adds money and complication, additional control wiring and so forth that you'd need to have and remembering what you've got and so forth. Part of that can be taken care of by adjusting your equipment setup. But having the ability to see what's going on can be a real advantage. You know, one of the things about the remote tuner is an automatic remote tuner will tune whatever it sees as best it can.
Yes.
So if you're operating and say, gee, I'm not getting out as well as I usually do. Are the conditions bad? Or did my antenna fall down during the night or during the day and it's now nighttime and I can't see it and now it's happily tuning this piece of wire lying on the ground?
Yes.
and the transmitter looks fine. Everything seems to be fine. And there we go. And another thing that can happen with automatic tuners you have to be careful about, and you have to understand how yours works. Some automatic tuners automatically retune on a mismatch.
Yes.
Which sounds like a good feature unless you have a transmitter that doesn't like a sudden change in load. And what happens is if you're putting full power out and all of a sudden the antenna tuner starts changing inductors and capacitors and throwing switches and all of a sudden your SWR is hopping all over the place, you could conceivably damage your transmitter as a result. And also the tuner, by the way. Some tuners like to tune at low power and then operate once the tuning is set.
Correct.
So if you have a tuner like that starts tuning on its own, you have to either have a loop back that comes back to the radio and turns the power down, which some do, but again, that's additional control signals, or be very careful to make sure it doesn't happen when you don't expect it. So you're putting 1,000 watts into this thing and all of a sudden it starts going through gyrations. You can damage the tuner itself by making relay contacts close when they're full power and so forth. Or you can damage the transmitter if it sees a load that it doesn't expect that happens very suddenly. Most transmitters will cut back power if they're having a problem like that, but they often can't do it instantaneously.
No.
So it depends on the design of the transmitter. So those are things to think about.
Joel, I have one more question for you, but before I get there, let's take a break and hear from DX Engineering, and we'll be right back.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime, and we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back. Joel, I promised a question, so here it goes.
Okay.
Now, imagine a remote antenna tuner, but I can't install it directly at the feed point of my dipole antenna because that's 40 feet up in the air. So I put the remote tuner on the ground, and I know I'm going to have still 40 feet of feed line between the output of that remote tuner and the feed point of the dipole. So how about if, and let's assume the remote tuner has a balanced output, or let's assume I'm using a balun. I use instead 40 feet of 450 ohm windowed line. I mean, will that kind of configuration work in terms of at least keeping the loss in that 40-foot section reasonable for the remote tuner?
Generally, that's absolutely true, and that's a good idea. It will work, and it's frequently done. You know, but even if you had to use coax for some reason, keep in mind that 40 feet of coax that's not matched will have, you know, only 40% of the loss of the 100 feet that if you didn't have a tuner out there at all. So that's one thing. But the window line will have less loss generally, and sometimes it can be used for multiple bands, which you couldn't do if you were trying to do it all with coax, that sort of thing.
Exactly, that's the idea, yeah.
So there's no reason not to do that. Open wire line is even slightly better than window line if you want to use that. And sometimes if it's out there in the woods, it's not particularly harder or more visible than window line.
So what you're saying then, if I'm understanding you correctly, is I don't necessarily have to use a balanced feed line from the output of the remote tuner. If, again, we're only talking about 40 feet, I could use, say, 40 feet of LMR 400, some very low-loss type of coaxial cable, and dispense with having to use a balun.
That's absolutely correct. Well, you can do whatever you want. I mean, the point is what you have to do is understand what the SWR is in that coax, which you can easily measure.
Mm-hmm.
And then having done that, you can determine what the loss would be in different types of coax. And, of course, 40 feet of coax will have 40% of the loss of 100 feet of coax. So it's, you know, I use 100 feet because it's kind of a convenient number, but what's really important is how many feet of coax you have. If you only have 10 feet of coax, it's probably not going to matter too much where you put the tuner, especially if you have good coax. And that's another point. You can, there's a big difference between coax types. As an example, we talked about RG8X. Well, if you had, instead of RG8X, you had RG213, which is the modern RG8 0.4-inch diameter coax. Instead of 1.9 dB and losing 35%, you'd have 1.2 dB and you'd lose 24%. So, you know, you get an improvement there. And LMR 400 is even better, and LMR 500 is even better than that. And so you can go up from there with different kinds of coax.
How about 40 feet of hard line? Half inch
hard line? Oh, yeah, that's good stuff. Well, and here's another point. Depending on what kind of antenna you have, and if you're going to have a tuner out there anyway, there's nothing magic about 50 ohms. So you might be able to find some rigid cable TV hard line, 75 ohm. And, you know, if you have a dipole that has a nominal impedance of 75 ohms, roughly, that actually will have less loss than a 50 ohm cable going to that antenna. And that can be free, especially in small pieces, which might be exactly what you want. So
exactly.
Think about that. Now, the downside of that is it's heavy, and one of the problems with that compared to window line is this heavy coax tends to pull down the feed point and make the antenna sag unless it's supported in the middle. So there always are trade-offs with different kinds of things, but there are many solutions to any problem, and each needs to be evaluated with the pros and cons and the numbers associated with it in terms of attenuation, and usually you can make a pretty reasonable decision. But don't go by what your transmitter sees at the input to the antenna tuner, because that will always look good. And the transmitter will be happy as a clam. And
you'll think everything is perfect.
Well,
and it's far from perfect.
It's far, yeah, perfection.
Or could
is,
be, yes.
Perfection is hard to come by. But, you know, as far as the transmitter is concerned, tuning into an antenna tuner right there at the transmitter is happy as a clam. In fact, the SWR will look lower than it is because of the loss in the transmission line. So the antenna tuner will be happier. Everything will be happier except you and the people who are trying to listen to you. And by the way, you know, if you're down 70%, that's, I can't do that in my head. Let's see, 4 or 5 dB. That's less than an S unit. So you'll still make plenty of contacts. So just turn on that linear amplifier, and that'll make up for a lot of loss. But seriously, if you want to optimize your station and having it work very well, you need to understand where this loss is happening and minimize it to the extent that's reasonable. There always will be loss, and that's just part of the game.
How do you feel about having the remote antenna tuner exposed to weather? And even if you're shielding it from moisture, I mean, here in New England, of course, it can be subjected to sub-zero temperatures at night. It can be broiled in the daytime in the summer. I mean, over the long term, what do you think?
Well, those things certainly don't add to its longevity in general, but each antenna tuner should have, in fact, all equipment should have specifications, and they should have a storage temperature range and an operating temperature range. They're usually different. The storage one is usually a little wider. And if you compare the temperature range to what the temperatures you'll subject it to are, you'll have a good idea whether it should stand up. I think in most cases it's not a big problem.
Well, would you like me to throw a softball question at you or a hardball question?
whatever suits you.
Okay. Well, Adrian, VE7NZ, is asking, after listening to your podcast episode on coax connectors, it occurred to me that I had a related question that you didn't cover. I was working on some cables on my tower when I realized that a connector wasn't looking very healthy, so I decided to change it. The connector had been covered with rubber sealant, actually, yet when I went to prepare the cable end for the new connector, I found that both the shield braid and the center conductor were so corroded they were black. I have seen this in the past and have been able to cut off a few inches and have been able to find shiny new copper braid to work with again. Alas, Adrian says, this cable is corroding along its entire length, and the braid seems to have adhered to the inside of the PVC jacket in places. I am not sure how old this cable is, but maybe even sealed cable goes like this after 15 or more years on the roof. Should I replace the entire cable?
I think actually this is kind of normal for some types of cable, and it's important to understand the differences, and the age may have a lot to do with this. I have also seen coax in that condition and been somewhat surprised. So if it isn't normal, it's certainly not unique since I've done it. I suspect that our cables were old enough so that they did not have a non-contaminating jacket. And the earlier contaminating jackets were made of insulating material that tended to migrate into the shield, actually. So what you have is this shield. Now, you think about shields, and they're made of a braid of wires that are kind of crossed over, and they're intended to be in contact with each other, all these little wires, so it acts like a tube, like a metal tube, and that's what helps do the shielding. Now, I'm not sure exactly what the properties are of oxides of copper, but what I've seen is that the jacket material goes into the braid, and that at the same time it sort of opens up the jacket, so you end up with moisture in. So the thing about the insulating and covering material on the connectors that you talked about, that may well have done a great job of keeping the connectors from getting water in them, but that doesn't help if the water penetrates the whole cable along its whole length.
Yes.
So what you've been having is this cable going down your tower and the water runs down the outside from all the rain that collects on the antennas and everything else, and it just goes into the cable and you've got this massive corrosion problem in there. And I think then that the individual wires of the shield are not making contact with each other anymore. Now what this means is they may actually make end-to-end contact. So if you check them with an ohmmeter, it may show the same DC resistance as the day it was new, but I'm thinking that can't possibly work as well as a shield as if it had been new. So that's, I think, the basis of your problem, and I think it's common to any cable with a contaminating jacket or that is not a non-contaminating jacket. It is important to recognize that there are multiple types of jackets that are found over the coax shields, and I expect that the jacket that we are talking about experiencing was a PVC 1 type. This is black contaminating polyvinyl chloride, PVC. And that what happens is they break down from the ultraviolet radiation from sunlight. They also cannot be buried. And they have a shorter, as we can understand, they have a shorter rated lifetime than,
yes,
than our other kinds of cables. So, you know, they're fine for indoor cabling. They're fine for jumper cables, and they're flexible and all that kind of stuff. But most cable nowadays, I think, is the non-contaminating type. There are a couple types. Those PVC 2A jackets are quite common on high-quality cable. They are UV resistant, and thus they will not break down in sunlight. And some are even rated for direct burial without conduit. And this is very helpful. So this typically has a stated 20-year life cycle as compared to 10 years or less for the contaminating type, depending on the environment. And then there's another type you might want to consider, too. It's PE3A. Which is a high-density polyethylene. This is stiffer than PVC. It has a shiny, hard finish. I just used some of this on an antenna I made over the last few weeks, in fact. It is weatherproof and tougher. So it's very good for stationary environments that will get a lot of wear. I used it for a field day antenna. It's also good for applications that don't require a lot of flexing because they are stiffer, and they're somewhat harder to work with and so forth, but they have their advantages. So there's PVC-2A and PE-3A, and they're both non-contaminating types. And for general applications, I think PVC-2A is the one you want to look for. So I think most coax cables these days are made that way. But before you buy one, or when you pick one up at the Hamfest table that somebody had in his backyard for 40 years, you may want to ask yourself, what would happen if I looked inside this cable? What would I find? And if you, if they have connectors on both ends, it's very hard to tell what you've got inside in the middle without destroying the cable. So be leery of that, I would say. And you can get cable that will last as long as, certainly it'll last as long as I will. And but that may be more a reflection of my age than anything else. If 20 years is a reasonable life to expect from a good cable, and it shouldn't have that kind of problem. But now, of course, if the cable lasts that long, it's all the more important to carefully waterproof the connectors, because the connectors, especially UHF connectors, are not rated to stand up to water. So you can get water in the ends and have the problem you expected to find when you cut off the end of the cable, which is the last few inches have corrosion. But if the corrosion goes the whole length of the cable, you've got contaminating jacket
problems.
You've
got a problem.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, thank you very much, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.